Do you like books? I mean, really, really like books? Then you're in the right place. Each week, your host, Sam Hankin, interviews the best of today's top-selling authors and the up-and-coming superstars of modern literature. This is The Avid Reader. Here is your host, Sam Hankin.
Good afternoon, everyone, and welcome to another edition of The Avid Reader. Today, our guest is Whitney Scherer, author of her first novel, The Age of Light, released in February by Little Brown and Company. Whitney holds a BA in English Literature from Wesleyan and an MFA in Creative Writing from the University of Washington. Her short fiction has appeared in numerous journals. This, The Age of Light, as I said, is her first novel. The Age of Light gives us a unique, and for most of us, a previously unknown life. The life of Lee Miller, a beautiful, beautiful woman who has graced the covers of Vogue and other high fashion magazines of the time. Her beauty is renowned, and her ability to be a photograph is only outweighed by her desire to take one. She arrives, after having given up modeling, in Paris in 1929, essentially and eventually penniless, but she catches the eye of an artist whose name is known to all of us, Man Ray. He wants her to continue her life as a model by photographing her, but instead, Lee convinces her to take her on as an assistant. And even though Man turns out to be something less than the perfect lover, they begin a romance that is both torrid and mutually rewarding in its intensity. We see Lee also in the present when she has taken on a new look and a new passion. We see her on the battlefields of Europe as the war is ending, and she lingers to photograph the horrors that haunt her for the rest of her life. But we see her mostly as she learns to be a photographer, a movie actress, and once again, a model. This woman, who previous to this book was kind of lost in history, comes up with some remarkable ideas that are still important today, but for which at the time she received little or no attention. This is a beautiful story about a beautiful woman in many ways. She does have her flaws, and those are filled in seamlessly. But overall, this is a woman that I would like to meet and whom, as so many other men did, would probably fall in love with. With that, welcome Whitney, and thank you so much for joining us today.
Hi, thank you so much for having me.
So, how did you discover Lee, and what made you want to take that discovery and tell the rest of us about her?
So, I first learned about Lee Miller in 2011 when I went to an exhibit of her and Man Ray's work at a museum just north of where I live in Boston. And the exhibit was called Man Ray and Lee Miller, Partners in Surrealism. And I went to it because I've studied photography for my whole life, and I knew a lot about Man Ray, but I'd never heard of Lee Miller. So I went into the exhibit, and pretty much right away, as soon as I started seeing her work, I was just captivated by her talent and who she was. She just seemed to be really confident, really ambitious, and kind of ahead of her time in every way. And I found myself, as I was looking at her work, just getting kind of more and more aggravated that she wasn't as much of a name as Man Ray was. So that's where the novel began for me, was just in, you know, seeing her work and thinking what an incredible story her life would make. And then, you know, once I left the exhibit, I just dove in and started researching and reading anything that I could find about her.
The interesting thing when I was kind of researching for this interview was, of course, I went to Google and Wikipedia. And when I went to Google, I just clicked on images. And as I scroll through them, literally like other men, it's like you fall in love with her. And there was that one picture of her when she has short hair and she's wearing that kind of sweater with that little V at the neck. And it's just such, and she's looking right through the camera. And it's just such, I don't know, you have this almost frisson of wanting to be with her. Do you know what I mean? I'm sure you do.
Oh, yeah. She was incredibly beautiful. I mean, she was so beautiful that I think she was the sort of person who would get stopped on the street, and you know, it was that level of beauty. And I think that she knew how to use that beauty to get what she wanted, especially when she was young. But I do think as she got older, that beauty became more of a hindrance to her because she realized that it was hard for her to be known for anything other than her beauty. So that was one of the things that really interested me and that I tried to explore inside the novel.
Yeah, it's fascinating that, you know, that I didn't know about her. And then I realized Picasso, Ernst, Duchamp, the director,
yeah.
Cocteau. Who knew? I mean, granted, you didn't know, I didn't know, but who knew that there were all these people that felt that way about her?
Yeah, it's true. I know. She was a muse to, you know, many of the artists of the time. And I think, I think she might have been more well-known in today's time if she hadn't stopped making art. After World War II, she literally just boxed up all of her photos and negatives and put them in her attic and didn't talk about being a photographer anymore. So she wasn't out there kind of championing her own legacy. And so I think that might be a piece of why, we don't know her as well as we know somebody like Man Ray.
Was it her son who gathered everything together after her death?
Yeah. So she actually didn't tell her own son that she had been a photographer, and he found out basically on her deathbed right around 1977. And then after she had passed away, he has devoted his life to bringing her legacy back to the light. And so he started an archive of her work at the farmhouse where she spent the latter half of her life in the south of England. And he's been really instrumental in, bringing her work to different exhibits around the world and all sorts of stuff.
Yes. Like I said, it is fascinating that she was completely unknown. And it's also fascinating how, as you said earlier, her beauty was, wonderful for her, but it was also a little bit of an albatross around her neck. And and then when she went to Germany after the war, she stayed behind, and then there's that picture of her in the tub that was Hitler's tub. And it was almost like, I don't want to say perverse, but she had this fascination with the horror of the war. Do you think that heralded back to her own childhood and the trauma that she experienced then?
Yeah, I think it absolutely did. She experienced a lot of trauma in her childhood, and I think that had repercussions throughout her life, and it made it hard for her to form and keep relationships. And she had a very complicated relationship with her sexuality and, that. And then when she got to World War II, I think that having experienced trauma earlier in her life, I think it actually, in certain ways, it helped her make the art that she made during the war, because that she, when you look at her photography from the war, she has this very intimate connection to these very disturbing images that she's shooting. And, you just feel that she kind of can't separate herself from that. And I think that does come from having experienced earlier trauma. But I also think that, the war was sort of like the final trauma, or, the another trauma laid on top of what had already damaged her. And I think that was too much for her. So when she was in it, and she was in the war, and the war had ended, and then she was out driving through Eastern Europe and still wanting to be out there photographing how the countries were, healing after the war, she didn't want to go home, because she really craved that excitement and just that sense of being in it. And so then when she did have to go back to England, her credentials were revoked, and they stopped sending her money, so she couldn't travel around anymore. And I think it was really, really, really hard for her. She actually she talked to a therapist, because post-war she was depressed, and she became an alcoholic, and she was really struggling. And the doctor said something, I probably can't quote it exactly, but he said something like, "We can't keep the world permanently at war just to keep you entertained, Miss Miller," which is pretty wild.
Yeah, it is, because, again, for the reader, it's historical fiction, but a lot of it is, again, when you read, for example, the Wikipedia article or some of the books, a lot of it is exactly as it happened or seems to be. And it was almost like she was imposing the trauma of the war on herself, because it affected her for the rest of her life. And then the interesting thing in the book is how, and I was kind of worried about this, because in the beginning, there's this initial chapter, and I'm thinking, wait a minute, am I going to be interested in this woman? Because, she's cooking and she's drinking and she's not happy. And, and then you also tie it to the end when she's also back in the present. And it does come full circle. And then I realized once you switched to the past and her initial time in France that, oh, yeah, I'm really hooked on this now. But you see what I mean? In the beginning, it wasn't what I expected.
Yeah, yeah. No, I did that intentionally, as I suppose, writers do most things intentionally, I guess. But, you know, I wanted people to meet her when she was struggling and when the complications of what she had experienced in her life were really manifest in how she was behaving and, you know, how she felt and what she looked like. And it just seemed kind of too easy to begin the story when she was 22 and beautiful and had everything going for her. So I do think it is a little bit of a shock, you know, when you read that prologue and you think, wow, like, who is this woman? Do I want to spend, you know, the next X number of hours reading this book about her? But at the same time, I hope that it gives some depth to the earlier part of her story, because then you have a sense of where she ends up.
I know. And it makes you sad in the same way it makes you sad. Like, I was talking to my mother the other day. She's 96 and she won a beauty contest. She was like Lee in the sense that she was extremely beautiful, and she was saying, you know, it's when I look in the mirror, I can't believe what I see, and I remember what I looked like, but now when I look in the mirror, it's not what I want to see. And there's a real poignancy there.
Well, absolutely. And doesn't everybody feel that way?
No.
I don't. As people
when
age, you know, you always see your younger self inside whatever age you are, you know, and there is that poignancy is the perfect word for that, I think.
Yeah, the thing I've done is whenever I look in the mirror, I go, oh, I'm just seeing myself. That's just me. And somehow, so far, that's worked.
That's a pretty healthy attitude.
Yeah, it's just me again. But I don't know how much longer, like I said.
Yeah, right.
There's so many, like, little interesting, not little, but very interesting moments in the book we could talk about. You know, I don't like, usually I get near spoilers and I always stop. But I really should think there aren't spoilers here because it's essentially nonfiction in a lot of ways. But I still will try to stay away from them. But
okay.
But little things like the white ball, the blank wall ball, that she essentially did on her own, and also set up so that Man Ray would not be happy with the conclusion of it for a number of reasons. That was all. I'm thinking, wow, that really happened. That was she planned by throwing out something. That would have been very important to him. She planned by having Antonio there. Did you take any liberties with that, or?
Yeah, you know, I did take some liberties with that, to be honest. So, you know, I would say, and I took liberties throughout the novel, certainly.
Sure.
Everything that happens in the book is grounded in fact, and I think, you know, I spent a lot of time thinking about, if I do fictionalize something, am I staying true to what the characters, or, you know, what the what the people that the characters are based on, what they would have done in real life. So if I have them doing something that I've fictionalized, I want to be able to point to a fact that I read and say, well, they didn't do this exact thing that I have them doing in the novel, but they did this other thing, and it's completely within their character that they would have also done this fictional thing. So the scene that you're talking about at the end, the ball blanc did happen. Lee was flirting with other men there and making Man Ray extremely jealous, and they were partners in kind of putting the ball together. But it didn't shake down exactly in real life like it does in the book.
I see what you mean, because it's like the mesh saber protector. I mean, because I've seen the photographs. So,
oh, yeah.
Yes, they purchased it or they got it. And then the way you take off and the way they're going, like, through the flea market and all that, it was fun to read. And it was also something you could think, oh, wow, this may very well be the way this happened. But there certainly is much more than a kernel of truth. You have photographic evidence that this is what they bought and this is what they did with it.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, that's a great example, actually, because that it's a saber guard, which was this sort of protective metal mesh that they used for fencing. And I had seen photographs taken by Man Ray and taken by Lee Miller using the saber guard. And what's so interesting is the way that they photographed it. They each used it in different ways. So when Man Ray took a photograph of Lee Miller wearing the saber guard, he had it over her head, almost like a helmet, kind of, but it has this interesting, but also a little creepy kind of S&M vibe to it in a way. And then when Lee Miller took photographs with it, she used a different model. I don't think she did self-portraits, but she had a woman wearing it almost like a shawl around her shoulders. So it's just a completely different, much more sensual kind of soft image that she uses this object for. And that really captivated me. And so in the book, I have them both using this object in different ways, you know, slightly different than what they did in real life, but, you know, certainly grounded within those images that I had looked at while I was writing the story.
I like the way that Lee was upset and kind of exasperated with Man Ray when he used a model that she thought was, like, you know, not giving anything back at all.
Oh yeah.
Didn't want to be there. And, you know, that's when she was kind of torn between being the photograph or taking the photograph.
Yep, exactly. Yeah. You know, I tried to write her as I think she was in real life, which is, I think she was, you know, complicated like we all are. And I think she got annoyed when she saw other women kind of getting treated the way that she wanted to be treated or not behaving in the way that she thinks that they should behave. And, you know, I had fun playing with that throughout the book.
Well, you know, we talked about this a little bit before we began the show, but since we were talking about the different ways in which Man Ray and Lee composed those photographs, talk a little bit about the photographic technique, the solarization, the idea that how Lee learned about dodging and things like that, because that was also very fascinating, and especially given your lifelong study of photography.
I wanted to include a lot of, you know, different information about photographic techniques. That's my dog.
Yep.
Barking in the background.
I knew he would be there sometime.
she just keeps on barking. But anyway, I wanted to include information about photographic techniques, but I also didn't want to burden the novel with too much of it. So I was trying throughout to kind of strike a balance between how much information is there, but also making it really part of the story. And you know, that solarization was a technique that Man Ray and Lee Miller did discover together in interviews. She talks about how she kind of accidentally discovered the technique through a mistake that she made in the darkroom. And then after that, she and Man Ray perfected it together. So that was something that came from real life and was just really just such rich ground for fictionalizing, because you know, I think the darkroom in general is such an amazing space to put two characters together inside of, just because it's dark and intimate, and it's both about this act of creation and kind of bringing images to life, and also a place where they were getting to know each other and their relationship was sort of coming to life as well.
You made it incredibly intimate because they were so close that there was no room for anything but them to be touching each other. Was it really that close? I guess it would be, right?
Yeah, well, one of the descriptions that I read of Man Ray's darkroom was that it was no bigger than a bathroom rug, which is such a nice little description. But yeah, so I think it was really tiny, like a closet, kind of.
And she was the one, well, you're speaking from her point of view in it, but she was the one that felt the feelings that were bringing her closer to him at that time. And, you know, he wasn't that, I mean, compared to Antonio, for example, he wasn't that imposing a figure in terms of attractiveness, being handsome, you know, mm-hmm. wasn't bad, but, you know, but then again, you have Antonio. And mm-hmm. and the thing about Lee is, and again, this might be because of her childhood, at least the way we talk about her in your book, is that she longed for, but again, was repulsed by this idea of these short-term, almost forced relationships that she had over the course of her life.
Yeah.
Some of them lasted hours.
I think she, you know, exactly what you said. I think she kept doing the same thing again and again, even though she didn't necessarily want to be doing it, and having short-term relationships with men. And I think what she really wanted was to have a deeper, more lasting relationship, like the one that she was, you know, beginning to have with Man Ray. But it also that also kind of left her feeling constrained and sort of upset in a different way than the short-term relationships made her feel. And I do think it does go back to that early trauma.
Plus, it's not only the early trauma, it's what I guess you could call trauma about the relationship she had with her father.
Oh, yeah. Well, I guess when I talk about her, she really had two huge traumas as a child, because she was raped by a friend of the family at the age of 7, and then starting at the age of 8, her father started taking nude photographs of her, which he did well into her 20s. And, you know, the way he described it was that in some sense he was supposedly helping her heal from the trauma of this rape by taking these photographs of her. But certainly to a modern audience, that makes no sense. That makes no sense to me at all. But, I'm not sure what exactly he was thinking. But whatever he was thinking, it was a very traumatic thing for a woman to go through, a girl to go through. And I think it definitely made Lee feel that she had been objectified by the person, the man who was kind of the closest to her for her whole life.
Tell us about the incident in which it's kind of like it's like some of the things that happen today, like a Kardashian thing almost, like what happened to her when her photograph was not known to her but was used in that advertisement, and then what her father did.
Oh, yeah. So, yeah, and this comes kind of early on in the book. But, yeah, she was photographed by Edward Steichen, who was a huge name at the time. And, I mean, you know, still is. He's a renowned photographer. And he took a lot of photos of her for Vogue magazine and other places. And he had taken a picture of her wearing this white satin dress, and lovely photograph, actually. And then the image was sold to Kotex, and it was used in one of the first advertisements for women's sanitary pads. And so it was really, it was like, it caused a lot of drama at the time. And it was, came about right around the same time that she was deciding whether or not to give up modeling. And her father was really displeased about it. And in the book, even more so, I think, perhaps, than in real life. But it was this definite turning point for her, where I think it suddenly made her aware of the downside of having all of these images of herself that were kind of beyond her control.
Yeah, and it's not like he held that grudge against her forever, but there was still a strange relationship. Like when he came to Paris and met Man Ray, he still had that same, I don't know, this authority over her that she wasn't really pleased with and didn't want to submit to.
Yeah, but, you know, I think she, and I hope this comes through in the book, what I wanted her to be feeling there is this loyalty and love for him, but also this huge resistance to him and to his authority. And so there's just so much complication when he comes to Paris and inserts himself into her new reality. And because I just, you know, that actually, a piece of that came from some photos of them that I'd seen together. Man Ray actually did take a portrait of Lee with her father. And in the portraits, there's a couple different images. And in one of them, she's sitting on his lap. I mean, she's 22 or 23 in the photograph. And it just, she looks deeply uncomfortable. And it's just such an odd image. And then there's another one where she's standing next to him and she's kind of resting her head on top of his head, sort of. And he's sitting in a chair. And again, like, she just doesn't look like she wants to be there. And so that really, you know, that just captured me. I was like, what is this relationship that she has with this man, you know? It's fascinating.
Yeah, it is fascinating. You know, it was fascinating to me. And it was also like, I didn't dislike him.
Yeah.
I wasn't sure about whether he was a good guy or a bad guy. And then I realized, too, that in all likelihood, the fact that Man Ray was taking this portrait and the way you set up that scene would have also made her uncomfortable, too, especially because he didn't seem so happy to meet the father.
Oh, yeah. No, absolutely. I mean, can you imagine having your new lover take a portrait of you with your father, who the new lover is sort of weirdly jealous of. I mean, it's a very strange situation.
Yeah, and that's part of the time. You know, it's like, you know, the times make these people, just like what's happening today politically, for example. And it's like, you know, it's the 20s and the 30s, and it's Dada and surrealism and Dali and Picasso, and this abandonment of the concept of basically regularity.
Mm-hmm.
And you portray that very well in the book. And it's a time I think we can recognize, and I think that's why it's still, I was going to ask you this as a question, but I feel that all this still resonates with us today, and I wonder why it does. Like Man Ray, and like Picasso, and like Duchamp, and like Cocteau. Why do you think that is?
Oh, well, I mean, I think people seem just endlessly fascinated by the interwar period, you know, especially in Paris when there was all this amazing art being created. But I don't, that's probably not exactly what you're asking, but I do think that those artists just hold unbelievable sway over our imagination still. And they should, I think, because it was an amazing time. And I don't think that we've really ever quite, you know, achieved another period of time where there was as much, like, you know, music and art and literature all being created in one place. But I think also, you know, the sort of bohemian side of life then, I think, is also something that you know, maybe we saw that again in the 60s. And you know, that too, I think, also is something that people are fascinated by.
Would you kind of like to have lived in that time?
You know, I mean, wouldn't everybody? or you think you would want to live then? I don't know if I really would have wanted to be there, but it does seem, in certain ways, so romantic and amazing.
Yeah, especially like that, for want of a better word, that salon where everybody was doing whatever they wanted to do, and there was room after room. And
right?
Yeah, that would be, I would
love
to.
That would be cool, yeah.
And you have to find a bedroom that's unlocked. That's another thing you did really well, was handle all the sex.
Oh, thanks. I gave the sex a lot of thought, which maybe that sounds weird, but I did, you know, I thought that Man Ray and Lee Miller were really sexual people, and I wanted to portray them that way because I think sometimes in historical fiction, you end up getting these scenes where characters are like looking longingly at each other across a ballroom, and then the chapter ends. And I thought, that's not going to do justice to these people who were really just very physical and just sexy, you know?
Yeah, I do know. And the way you portrayed Antonio from the first time to the second time to the third time, and then to the time when they were together. Yes, I could understand exactly her feelings towards him, and I could understand how attractive a person he was.
And yeah, me too. I've got a little crush on Antonio.
I know. I thought I did too. It was horrible. That's how nice looking you made him.
Excellent.
But, you know, I wanted them. I felt he was a really nice guy. I felt really bad for him because
I know. Yeah, he was treated. He wasn't treated so well, was he?
No, and yeah. I felt like, okay, well, you know, you didn't have to do that.
I know. But I think Lee is pretty. I think she was. You know, she was self-destructive and destructive in general, I guess. And yeah, he kind of took the brunt of that, I think, which is a shame.
Yeah, especially when he looks up and he's just confused.
No.
Because he's like, you know, not the sharpest knife in the drawer. But he's just wondering, why would that happen?
Yeah, I know. He's like, why am I here? Yeah.
Yeah. That's another thing that was good about that first chapter, especially in retrospect. Gosh, it's like she's kind of really fed up with herself, and there's not much she can do about it, except try something different and keep drinking.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's true. And, I think doesn't everybody feel those feelings of just being fed up with yourself sometimes? I certainly do.
Pretty much every night.
Yeah. Yeah, right. Right before I have that nightly cocktail? No.
Well, that's the thing about life is that you don't really decide. It decides for you. It's like sliding, mm-hmm. like sliding doors. You know, it's a phone call or a split second when you turn one way instead of the other, so you don't see the person or you do. I mean, that's what really happens, and
it's true. I know it's all kind of completely random at some level. You know.
Yeah. Look where you are now. Did you expect to be here? I don't know. You know, it's really hard.
Yeah. No, I did not. How about that?
Also, you know, this would make a really good movie too. I don't know if anyone's approached you, but it would make a great movie.
Well, yeah, there's been a little bit of interest. But actually, the Lee Miller's son, Anthony Penrose, is working on a movie about her life already.
Oh, okay.
So that is in production, and Kate Winslet is set to star as Lee Miller. So I think, I know everything takes forever in Hollywood, but I think that film is actually being made. And then they're talking a little bit about potentially turning my book into a miniseries, which would be really, really cool.
That's what seems to happen now, you know, with Netflix or Hulu or something like that.
I love a good limited series show. I think it's like such a great form. It's kind of like a novelistic form.
Yeah, but then my son binge watches Breaking Bad and spends the entire weekend in bed doing it. Or
that's the downside.
It is very cinematic, and you know, it's funny because, and I'm sure you've read these, but you know, I looked at The Art of Lee Miller. I looked at Lee Miller on both sides of the camera,
mm-hmm.
and but as you said, when you first saw the exhibit, you went, "Who is Lee Miller?" And I really had no idea at all, and you know, it brings me back to the idea that. What gave men the right then, which they still kind of have today, of taking liberties? Hey, so, and did, when he was looking for that award in Pennsylvania, did he really send what he sent instead of his own stuff?
So that Camera Society and that prize is completely made up, but he did sign his name to some of Lee Miller's work throughout their time together, and so that's where that's where that came from.
Is there a triptych like that?
There's something very similar, not that exact thing, but the Bell Jar series that is that's described in there. Lee does have those photos, not as a triptych, but she took photos just like the ones I describe.
An interesting scene was when she goes to the ballet and she tries for a couple of reasons. And she tries to get Man Ray to go as well. And then her feelings about photography seem to be interchanged with the way she feels about the ballet. And I wondered about that, too. Why you chose to do that.
I thought, I was thinking a lot about this idea of the type of work that Lee Miller would make. And then the type of work that she did make during the war, which was a more sort of in-the-moment, like, photojournalistic style of photography versus something that's more carefully, created in a studio setting. And I was trying to compare that to the idea of dance and the immediacy of seeing real bodies on a stage, bringing art to life kind of with their physicality. And so that was the connection for me between dance and the type of photography that I wanted Lee to want to make.
So kind of to like close out and bring this to the end as we bring the novel to the end. In the end, did they actually, in their dotage and their illnesses, did they actually meet up and have a chance to do whatever it is they did? I don't know what they did, and you don't really know what they did, and you left it that way, kind of. But did they really have a chance to do that?
Yeah. In real life, it happened a little bit differently. Yes, they did have that chance late in life to come together, actually at a museum exhibit, and so there's a lot of similarities there. The only difference is that they... when their relationship ended in the 30s, they lost touch, and you know they had this very tempestuous breakup, and then they lost touch until after World War II. But then they actually reconnected after the war, and they became friends, like sort of casual friends, throughout their life. And they didn't see each other very often, but they did end up seeing each other in a way that's similar to the end of the novel, where when they were both quite old. But I sort of compressed that down for the novel a little bit.
No, it was very good the way you did it.
Thanks.
I think it's better than the way it happened in real life, because it's nice to have one moment where you can look back. It's like what we were talking about.
Yeah, yeah. And that's the moment that matters, right? Is that moment of connection where they come back together, I think.
Yes, and it's also like we were talking about earlier, when you look in the mirror, here's a man in a wheelchair, and there's her, and you go, well, it's all over now, isn't it?
Yeah, I know.
Yeah,
it's kind of sad.
Both of us are feeling the same thing now. Well, thanks so much for being here. This was great. And the other thing I didn't tell you was I have an independent bookstore, Wellington Square Bookshop. And, you know, since this came out, a month ago or thereabouts, it's been on the front table. And whenever I'm there, I say, hey, if you want to read a great book, you know. And also the cover is great, which, you know, as I said to a lot of people I interview, people say you can't judge a book by its cover. But everyone who walks into my bookstore judges every book by it.
Well, that's great. I didn't know you had a bookstore. That's so exciting. And thank you for recommending my book to everybody. It's wonderful.
Yes, I can do. I'm a good seller.
I bet you are.
So anyway, if you're ever in the neighborhood and you want to come by and do a signing or something like that, we would love to have you, or Skype in for a book club or something.
Absolutely. I would be happy to do either one of those things. Just let me know.
Okay. Thanks so much for being here, Whitney.
Oh, thank you. Great to talk to you.
So that, I think, was a great talk, because I think we felt the same way about not only Lee Miller, but about some of the things we experience in life as we swim through it. And it's on the front table at the bookstore, and I highly recommend it. And as I said, in the beginning, I thought, well, maybe this is going to be like a chick book or something like that. You know, not to use that word, really, I don't like it, but it was a really good story about someone who really lived and who was really important and really beautiful. And I encourage you to look her up on Wikipedia before you read the book and look at her pictures, because she's just one of a kind. And then keep joining us. We have this great novel by Nathan Englander, who's written several. His latest one is called Kaddish.com. And it's kind of really funny, but at the same time, it's, as I used the word earlier today, kind of poignant and kind of like how you spend your life trying to make amends for the mistakes you made when you were younger. And then Charlie Jane Anders is going to discuss her book, which is The City in the Middle of the Night. And that book is science fiction, but you wouldn't call it hard. Well, maybe you would call it hard science fiction, but it's set in the future on a planet that is rotationally locked with its sun. So one side is constantly freezing cold, the other side is constantly boiling hot, and about the civilization that lives on the perimeter of that both inhospitable climates. So anyway, that's really good. I like that, because I love science fiction too. So in any event, those are the ones coming up. And I also wanted to tell you that we have this author from Sports Illustrated and ESPN's reporter Rick Riley for a hilarious evening on Thursday, April 4th from 7 to 9. Rick is launching his new book, which is called Commander and Cheat, which is perfect for me because it's a tongue-in-cheek look at Donald Trump on the golf course. You know, and the way he cheats on the golf course is very similar to the way he's cheating us in everyday life. But it's really funny, and from someone who really knows sports. So he'll give a brief presentation, a Q&A with the audience, and he'll sign books. So that'll be at the bookstore April 4th from 7 to 9 p.m. So thanks, as always, for joining us, and we hope that you'll be here next week on The Avid Reader.